Welcome to The Running Public with Bracken Crocker and Kirk DeWint.
Whether you are a brand new runner or you already have a great mustache,
we're here to help you increase your running knowledge and present it at a practical level. This is The Running Public. When you're ready to take your training or racing to the next level, go to therunningpublic.com. We have both monthly subscription training plans, $19.99 a month, and Bracken and I both offer one-on-one customized coaching. Again, go to therunningpublic.com and check out our offerings.
Our power just went out like 3 minutes before I was supposed to join, and I've just been wandering around the house trying to find the place with the most cell phone service so I can tether up my phone and do this call. So I apologize.
Lunar eclipse, man.
Yeah.
It's going to get us
all. The world is just falling to pieces.
How does the power randomly go out? I actually had this happen to me 2 weeks ago out of nowhere. I think, Bracken, weren't you and I recording or something and I went black on you? Maybe not, but
I don't know.
Well, how does the power just go out? I don't understand that. It's crap.
It happens all the time here. There's a snowstorm right now, and I guess trees just fall on the power lines, and then it goes out.
Have you been getting a lot of storm lately?
I mean, this winter, we've probably had like 6 or 7 times where the power's gone out for anywhere from like, 6 hours to 2 days. So it's definitely...
So you have a generator, I assume?
No, we don't have a generator. We have a wood stove and some battery banks, and we just kind of just go off the grid for a little while. Yeah.
I just bought a generator, actually.
Nice. Yeah. There's like those things that you don't really need or want until you need, and then they're pretty nice.
I haven't seen you since the big announcement, so congrats.
Oh, thank you.
You and Lindsay.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. We're soaked. Very excited. It's going to be a new chapter of life.
How far out are you?
She's, I think, almost 6 months now. I don't know how many weeks that is. People always count in weeks, and it just confuses me. So, yeah. I think she's due, like, August 7th. So, I think it's, like, something like that. Mm.
The last time we chatted with your wife was, like, two years ago. When did we chat with Lindsay? And it was... We actually asked her about, family and what you guys were thinking there. And she sort of was hinting at like it was going to be sooner than later, but then she sort of went out of retirement and raced a bunch that year again. And then of course family didn't happen. That might've been 2 or 3 years ago. So my question is, were you guys like working on it finally, like officially?
We were like not trying, if that makes sense. We were like, we should like, if we have a kid, that would be great. And then we just like, nothing's really changed. And then, I don't know, like maybe in like August of last year, we were like, okay, maybe we should actually start trying. And then we just took like some random supplements and then like downloaded this app that like helps you time things. And then like a month later, it was like, boom. So I guess that stuff works. Or it could be coincidence.
That's all you need, random supplements.
Yeah, just random supplements, and then just go for it. Yeah.
I ask because we're in the middle of officially trying, me and my wife as well.
Nice.
And what I find, I'm a bit old. How old are you now, Ryan? I forget. You're probably what, like 5 years younger than me?
I'm like 37, I think. 36, 37.
You think?
So, somewhere around that range.
We've been trying since like August-ish, September. We got married in August, and she has the apps, and prenatal for men came in the mail 3 months ago, which I didn't know was a thing, like all the same exact stuff. But in talking, I have found, we don't need to go down too far down this, but like people like endurance athletes, especially on the male side and the women's side, who train very hard often can have a difficult time getting pregnant because they're just wiped all the time.
Yeah. Right?
Like high-end endurance
totally.
Athletes. Did you ever find that like part of the conversation?
Well, yeah, actually, Lindsay, like when we started really trying, Lindsay kind of like slowed down her training a bit and like gained a few pounds and that seemed to help with her hormones and stuff. And then for me, I just started taking the supplements and doing less saunaing, which I think helped. I think sauna is like the worst thing you can do if you're trying to conceive. So I would actually go in there with like ice packs on my nether regions into the sauna, and like so when I was training for Abu Dhabi, I was like doing that. It's pretty funny. Yeah,
it worked.
Yeah, I also heard this thing, and I mean, I don't know if it's true or not, but I think they called it like hot balls or something. And like guys who train a lot, like your resting body temperature is just elevated all the time because you're like working out and then, you know, recovering. And so I guess they have this thing where you're just hotter than you normally should be all the time, and it like kills off all the like male producing sperm, and then you're more likely to have like a female if you're like a, you know, an endurance athlete who's doing a lot of training, which I thought was kind of interesting. So maybe we'll have a girl. We'll see.
I have not heard of that, but that'd be fascinating.
Yeah. I think it's like some way for the gene pool to like rectify itself. Because I think if you just had all these guys just training all the time and being super macho, and they just kept having guys, then I don't know, it would just be like a bad situation. It'd just be too many crazy men running around. So
hot balls.
Odd balls, literally. Yeah,
well, we have our episode title. Good.
Yeah, it's great to hear you guys' voices,
not see our faces. It's better that way.
Me too.
Yeah. It's okay.
Where are you at right now? Are you on, what side of the border are you currently on?
We're in Quebec right now. So we're in the process of renovating. We bought like a farmhouse, like half an hour from where we live, and we're in the process of renovating it. So I was just, laying pipe, fun times, and doing some plumbing work before I jumped on this call.
Enough about.
Is that a pregnancy joke again, Bracton?
It was going to be a pregnancy joke, yeah. But then I self-censored it halfway through. Like an adult.
Wow. So
that was a good bridge there, Ryan.
Yeah, so we're in Canada. It's all good. It was like spring here yesterday, and now we have a foot of snow. So it's just winter just keeps coming back.
Before we get into anything deep, are you actively training for something? Does that disrupt you? Or are you just rolling with it?
So I'm my next.
Is there anything on your horizon right now?
Yeah, I'm going to Denali in May to climb that mountain a few different ways. Oh. So that's kind of like the next. It's not a race, I guess, but it's something that I'm going to go do, which is hard and big and cool. So that's what I'm kind of gearing up for, I guess. Yeah, the training for that's pretty similar to how I just train normally. So,
what is it exactly? Sorry.
So we're climbing Denali, which is the highest mountain in North America. And we're going to do it. Like, plan is to do it three different ways. Firstly, by the West Buttress route, which is kind of like the main standard route that most people just hike up with crampons on, and then we're going to climb a technical route called the Cassine Ridge, which is like actually like ice climbing and rock climbing with ropes and protection and things like that for, I guess, 9,000 feet of climbing to get to the summit that way. So that'll be pretty cool. And then we're going to go up hopefully a third time and ski this couloir called the Mesner Couloir, which is 61 degrees. Pretty cool. Big couloir that we're hoping to ski. So that's kind of the plan for the trip. And that's May 18th. We're going to be having our orientation on May 18th. So pretty soon.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's also crazy to think that there's still skiable runs in the United States in May.
Yeah.
We forget how high some of our peaks truly are.
Yeah. Yep. It's 21,000 feet up there. So it's going to be crazy. It's always snowy up there.
Well, this has to be a real change of pace, because since I've been aware of you as an athlete, what April generally means is you've already done Jacksonville, mm-hmm. and or whatever their opener is, whether it's Southern California or Jacksonville, and there's the second race of the series is in a few weeks, and then it's about to get steep. And that's kind of been the routine of most people's lives for the past almost decade. Is
yeah,
you have summer to play around and you have winter to play around, but this time right now is always OCR centric. And then the last 2 years, it really has not been. Is that good for you, or has that just been strange?
I think it's good for me. I think it's I love OCR and I love like competing and stuff, but there's so many other things I love to do, like doing SKTs or just climbing mountains or staying active. Or last few years I've done a lot more bike racing as well as like the, you know, Spartan races and some other stuff. So I think that just with less events maybe happening and less of a focus on the competitive side of things, it's kind of like opened me up to a whole world of possibilities of doing other things that I've like always kind of dabbled in and always really enjoyed doing. But yeah, maybe just being presented with more of an option to take the time and go do them.
Yeah, I always felt the single biggest downside of OCR was how controlling the season was.
Right.
Just the layouts of the races made your year pretty spoken for the most part. And it is cool to watch these athletes branch out and show how interesting the endurance world can be.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and we did just do the Saudi race like a month ago. So feel like that was my, like, paid my dues there. And then yeah, now we can go do other stuff too.
Yeah, that was a bizarre start to a year.
So bizarre. Yeah. It feels like a dream. You wake up from a dream and you're kind of like foggy on the details, and you're like, you start remembering little pieces here and there. That's what the entire situation feels like.
I was going to wait to dive into that race specifically, but I am curious now that you brought it up. Talk about the experience. Was it a little strange being out there? Did it feel like a big time race? Like, were you treated as royalty as it seemed from afar? Like, what was the experience like out there?
A little bit of everything. It felt like a big race just because literally everybody that you know who could like do well at that race was there, and there were so many people who were who we knew from other events and other competitions who were there. So it felt like a big kind of world-class event in that respect. It was kind of a very just surreal situation because it was an environment and landscape that nobody was really familiar with, and everything just seemed so alien. And then when we landed, we went to Casablanca for 2 days on the way there, which was kind of our idea to like break up the flight. So we spent 2 days there, and then we went to Medina, which was probably a mistake. We were like, oh, it's the closest airport, that'll be easy. We got there and it's like the second most religious city in the world, and like we did like a 40-minute run and people were looking at us like we were aliens. And and then we kind of got like abandoned there. They were like, yeah, we're gonna send a shuttle for you. And then they were like, yeah, the shuttle is gonna be there in like 2 days, and it's gonna get there at, you know, it's gonna pick you up at 5 p.m. and then it'll get to Alula at like 10 p.m. on like Friday night. And we're like, that does not work for us. And then they were cool enough to send a taxi from Alula. It's like a 3.5-hour drive, 4-hour drive all the way to Medina to pick us up and then drive us to Alula, which was nice. So then we got to spend a little time there just kind of hanging out. And it was a much better experience than Abu Dhabi 3 years ago when we were in the tents and there was the dune buggies and no one was sleeping and it was awful. Like, they had good food for us. And then the organizers were really good. Every time we like came up to them and were like, hey, this thing that you're doing doesn't make any sense, they would be like, oh, tell us more. And then we'd explain. And then they'd be like, all right, we're going to change that. And then they would change it.
That's right.
And they'd change it. And then it would be like, wow, look at that. Like, an organization that like listens to the athletes is amazing. So that was pretty cool.
Did they ever talk to you about, is that the biggest prize purse in OCR history? I think it was, right? I can't think of anything higher.
Yeah.
Ryan, you can hear us. Okay, you froze for a second. I always wonder, like, how those things, like, the inception of those things, like, where did that idea start? How does something like that even get funded? How do they justify the long-term payout of an event like that? Like, was there any understanding of how that was put together? That was my biggest curiosity with the whole thing.
Yeah, so I think it was the, I don't know if it was the Saudi government or the Alula government, one of the governments, which, like, Alula is like a city, like a tourism capital kind of Saudi. They just somehow got in contact with these guys at Cab Sports who put on Tough Mudders in the Middle East, and they basically said, like, we want to have this event. We think it'd be cool. And then they put up all this money and then it just happened. I don't know beyond that. Like, I think they want people to come to their country and experience it and hopefully bring positive vibes back to the country. And so that's their way of making it happen. And they just have exorbitant amounts of money to do this with. So it's like, hey, let's try OCR. Hey, let's try Formula One. Hey, let's try horse jumping. It's like, I guess it's just another thing for them to kind of throw in the wall and see if it sticks.
Mm. So this is, I mean, I don't know how much you know about it. So this is one of many endeavors, like their tourism board put together, for example, maybe.
Yeah.
And so this is one of, it's not just like, let's go all in on Tough Mudder and see if that brings in millions of people in tourism. It's just like one of, however many things. Yeah. Got it. That makes sense, I suppose.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a cool way of looking at it, I guess. Yeah, who knows if it's like works, but I think it definitely puts them on the map within different demographics. And like sport is usually a pretty positive thing for people. So like there was people at the event who just came to do it. Like there were a bunch of people who had traveled from, you know, like Dubai and like France and wherever. We were like talking with them and they were just like, yeah, we saw this thing on Instagram and we just signed up and here we are. And it was like, cool. So yeah, it obviously works for some people.
I don't know if you recall, probably don't, have no reason to, but you way back in the day ran a 50 miler, I believe, and then beat everyone a week later in the national series out in Montana. And after that race, you and I had a real brief conversation. I said, what is your best distance? And you said, I don't know, maybe 50 mile, maybe 100K. I don't know. Long though. Mm-hmm. And then for all the years since then, and I may even have mentioned this to you in our last conversation, but in every year since then, I've been thinking about how we all complain about the series not suiting our needs. And here you are thinking that your best distance is like five times longer than we're racing on a regular basis. And always struck me as just like an example of your range as an athlete. But then I saw after Alula, your post of, you know, after thinking about it, I've just determined that this was the worst possible course for my skill set. And I was a little surprised by that because it fit the distance you had talked about, maybe the duration you had talked about. So was that a reflection on how you've changed as an athlete, how the sport kind of has changed in its landscape, or just the specific terrain and obstacle style of Alula?
Yeah, the last one, the specific terrain and obstacle style. I mean, it was you could take a average 9-year-old kid and send them through that course and they would have no issues with anything on the course. It was very, very easy in terms of obstacles, in terms of, I think they had all this money and they like got given it to put on the event. And then basically their obstacle set was like a mini Mudder obstacle set. And they just had to like do what they could with what they had. And yeah, the running was quite flat. There was some soft sand in it, but I mean, I don't think that necessarily favors anyone as long as you have like decent muscular endurance there. And yeah, it was just, I think I'm a good runner and I think I'm good at that distance. And I think I'm good at obstacles over that distance. And I had really trained a lot for grip strength and grip endurance and like being able to do obstacles over and over and over for multiple hours, like fastly and efficiently, quickly and efficiently. And then we got there and I was like, wow, I did not need to do a single one of those sessions. It was literally just running. And yeah, John just outran the crap out of me. Mm. So that's what that's what it like came down to.
How much vert were you getting per lap on your watch?
Not very much. Maybe a few hundred feet. It was like one kind of gradual climb.
Oh, really?
It was one gradual descent. Yeah. It was pretty much flat.
So then why, in your opinion, didn't some of these very good runners do better? Is it that obstacles have become so ingrained into you that they were easy, or were they, was there some piece that these guys just got wrong?
Like who are you talking about?
I don't want to specifically call out names, but there are some people there who brought better 50K or 100K or 100-mile times to the race than what they saw. And maybe you didn't see it as drastically, but just looking at the previews on paper and then what happened, what happened to get people? Was there a trend over there that when you saw people breaking down on course, was there a trend for why?
No, I think it's just hard to show up at the start line ready to race for a lot of people. A lot of people, like, you know, there's probably five or six factors that could throw off someone's approach to a race like that. And it could be something like getting sick on your way over. It could be something like pushing the volume a little bit too much 3 weeks leading up to it. It could be something, you know, it could be a million things. So, like, that's one factor, is like getting to the start line healthy and fit and ready to race. And then I think the other one is like, I still had a good race. Like I was like in really good ultra running shape, and I was in pretty good flat running shape, coming into the race. And so I think I performed really well for myself. And that's, you know, that's the reason why I was able to beat someone like Mark Batras, who, is way quicker than me on like a, you know, a half marathon or something like that. But, yeah, I think my approach to training for the event was like really, really spot on for what I could do. And that just over that distance, you know, John was 2 or 3%, you know, I don't know, 1 or 2% faster than me. And that's all it came down to, because there was like all the intangibles that I'm good at, like carries and obstacles and transitions and compromised running and all these things. They just weren't really a factor at all. So yeah, I think all the people that maybe could have or should have done better on paper either just didn't, because it's an event and there's a race and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And then another factor is like, yeah, I did have a good race. Like I did run fast and hard for 9 hours. Like, yeah. So
just to your credit, Ryan, and to John's, I watched that race and then watched the Jacksonville sprint or super, whatever one it was, like within an hour of each other. I was doing the same workout and watching these back and forth. You guys were running so notably fast. Very rarely, and I've said this on a few shows since then, but very rarely does OCR look impressive. The running pace that was held throughout Alula was visually fast, and that's rare for us to say. So I would say that, yeah, it appeared that you outran people.
Yeah.
That it wasn't like, oh, he got lucky with a double carry or something. You ran well.
Yeah, it was a quick race. Like the course, there's basically a mile of like this gradual uphill, a couple obstacles, and then there was like a mile and a half of like soft sand, like quite soft sand, soft and wet. And through that section, we were running like around 10-minute mile pace, just because you couldn't, like it was just so soft. And then after that, it opened up and it got hard. And every time I looked at my watch, I was running around 6:30 pace for pretty much the whole race on that like back half of like the more runnable stuff. So like we were moving pretty good. And that slowed down maybe just, you know, 10 or 15 seconds a mile with the 8 hours. So yeah, it was like it was a quick race. And I think John, myself, Mark, Luca, all the guys who did well, we're running well.
It's impressive. I've been meaning to get this question to you about John. We've had John on after a few of his recent successes in the last year or so. But I'm super curious because you guys have kind of had each other's numbers like over the year, and obviously he's blown up like largely successful on the trail scene, which is freaking awesome to see and fun to watch. Which one has to make you a little curious for yourself to like get over there and sink your teeth into some of that. But two, my curiosity is you've raced him now in Alula. Like, has he leveled up more than like what you knew John as from previous years, which was a stud runner, as in like, whoa, John, like, is that another level of his fitness? Or do you think John is still the same level of his fitness as he previously was? I'm curious as to your perspective there.
That is a curious question. I think that John has refined his approach to training substantially. I think that in the first 5 years where he was doing mostly OCR, he was, a lot of his training was kind of maybe a little bit more just guesswork, and that now he has started training more specifically and more scientifically. And I think that has led him to be able to get more out of his natural fitness over the course of a long race like that. I think that he probably is about the same speed as he ever was over a 5 or 10K distance, but he can kind of hold that pace maybe better, and that he comes to the events more properly trained for the demands of those events. So kind of the things that I've been doing for my whole career, I think he's finally starting to figure out, and he is like such a naturally gifted runner that that is, you know, bumping him up a little bit in the events that he's training for. I don't think it's like John went from like, you know, a 5 to a 10 in the last few years. It's just he's like kind of started to approach it differently, and that is paying dividends in the events that he's focusing on. He also like focuses really specifically now on the events that he wants to do, and prepares for them over several months, and then only does a couple races a year. So I think that helps as well for him.
That's exactly what he outlined to us when we talked to him last, wasn't it, Bracken? It was pretty much like, hey, I've actually taken a serious approach to this now, and here's how I look at things. And we were actually kind of blown away with his training in previous years, like how he approached it, and it was a little more like lackadaisical and relaxed. And that's exactly how that would make sense to me, because that's kind of what he outlined. I don't know, what was it, a year ago, Bracken, we chatted with him after one of his major wins last summer, something like that?
Yeah, something like that. Despite you two always finding each other on course at World Championships, it seemed like you two couldn't have ever got there in more opposite ways. And it was always mind-blowing that like no matter what you two did, you were going to show up. But what he never had was that like I've always seen you as someone who just knows how to prep for a race. No matter what you look like you were doing in training, suddenly a race comes around and you know that you're going to show up ready for that. Where we saw a lot of times where John would get someplace and be like, I can't run altitude, or I can't do a double carry, or I wasn't ready for this. And then the next time he does much better at it, but you don't get caught with your pants down very often. And I think John's got to that stage of his career.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's funny. John was, we were in the airport because we were in the same flight from Alula to Doha. That's the place we went to. And we were talking and he was telling me about all his training things. And he was like, yeah, I do this thing now where I have these paces and they're like the gap paces based on the, you know, the gap from Strava. So I know that if I'm running at, you know, 4% grade, I have to run this pace to be at this percentage of my thing. And I was like, oh yeah, cool. I was like, yeah, I did that like 12 years ago. I just like created the algorithm based on like the power required to move a body and like accounting to the wind resistance. I had like a whole Excel spreadsheet like 10 or 12 years ago where I had like all these things done. And he was like, he was so proud that he had like figured this out. And I was like, just kind of like, cool. Like that's, you know, good for you, but like it's nothing new. So I think he's just finally figuring a lot of these things out. So it's cool.
That's true talent, right?
Yeah.
When you, whatever you do, you're really good off of it.
Yeah, no kidding. But yeah, he's definitely seeing a lot of success in the trail world, and I think he's doing Western States this year, so it'd be cool to see how that goes for him.
Yeah. It's fun to give us, like, OCR background people, like, somebody to root for in the trail world at the high level. Mm-hmm. Because, like, you want to root for the Americans, what we do anyways. You want to root for certain people you like. But, like, it's, like, kind of one for the little guys still. When, like, John goes out and does something and he says he has a background for the OCR and people are like, whatever, this guy. And then he goes and whomps them. So it's fun in that regard. But I want to ask you a selfish question, Ryan.
Or Lindsay at her skyrunning. Sure. That was awesome for us.
Totally.
Selfish question. This is something Bracken and I were talking about while we were waiting for you to hop on, and I want to get your take on this. And Bracken looks scowled like he doesn't know what I'm going to ask. And it's going to start with...
Well, most of what we talk about prior to an episode can't be aired. So I'm interested where this is going to go.
Clean it up when we hit the record button. Ryan, first question. How much do you weigh? I know it's a taboo question to ask, but I want to know.
I'm like 168 or so. Yeah. Right, or usually just under 170 pounds.
Okay. So, and I've noticed you speak in miles, feet, pounds. Is that normal for you Canadians to do that?
I'm trying to convert for you.
Oh, you're just such a nice gentleman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is great. So soaking wet, butt naked in the morning, I'm about 170 pounds. So we're roughly in the same ballpark. I'm 5'10 and nothing. And what are you, 5'10 roughly? Okay, so we're not far off in stats.
Yeah.
I'm 40 years old. I'm probably the fastest I've been in the 5K to half marathon distance that I've been in my adult life, actually. I'm going to say it, my speed is fantastic and my efficiency is great. However, as soon as we start... Oh, yes, Bracken? Oh, okay.
No, I just dozed off a little bit.
You were going slack.
No, I was stifling.
Oh, you were holding up a yawn.
Yeah, I'm
your
I'm very
chin
fatigued.
Started to slowly open like you wanted to say something. It threw me off. Okay.
No, I was trying not to yawn, but you caught me.
Oh, is that what it was? Okay. But when it comes to running uphill, I feel my body weight. I feel like I can fake it and let gravity do the work when I'm running flat. Downhill is great right now. But my body weight, I feel like, is a limiting factor, at least how it feels. And I also haven't been a mountain runner in my past life. Like, I picked this up as an adult. So do you have any hot tips? Like, what do you think as a heavier, cause you're a heavy guy for running so well at mountains, like your power output and speed for your weight's probably better than anybody I know. Do you have any ideas or thoughts on like running well uphill when you're not a string bean? And if so, like, what are those things?
That's a big recap question. Your question, Ryan, you're so slow in the flats compared to how fast you're on the hills, which I think is like the answer as well. Basically,
that's not what I said.
No, I know. I think because you guys have more of a history in running, maybe growing up with running and track running and being fast in that way, I think that you're able to get those, you know, fast paces out of your body a lot easier. So whenever I'm running like, you know, 5 minute mile pace or, you know, around that range, there's kind of like this tipping point where I just have to start working so hard. And it's like, and I've always been okay with that because I've never really needed to run much faster than, you know, like maybe 5:20 mile pace in events. And if I can be comfortable at that pace and do the obstacles well, then I can have a reserve at the end and do really well. So if it goes faster than that, I'm kind of screwed. But I think my capacity from just my aerobic capacity and like power output, if you look at it from like a cycling perspective, would probably be higher than a lot of the people who can actually run, you know, a quicker, you know, 1 to 3 mile pace than I can. So then as soon as you start going up the hills, that kind of side of the equation starts not mattering as much. And then the power to weight ratio, it's not like I'm like, when you're going uphill, power to weight ratio is like what it all comes down to. And
right.
So if yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
So in a roundabout way, you're telling me that I'm weak. Is that what you're saying?
Well,
is that what I'm catching?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I just think that, say, if you look at it from like a cycling perspective, say my like threshold is 400 watts. It's like the power I can do for 1 hour, and your threshold is probably somewhere around 350 or something like that. So that's like how much energy we can put out for an hour maximum. And so on the flats and stuff, because you've got good economy and because you're not fighting gravity, you know, you're probably just as quick as I am because you have more of a history in running and all these things. But then as soon as it starts going uphill, that discrepancy in the fact that, you know, I probably have 5 to 8% more power at my disposal, that discrepancy going uphill becomes more apparent. And I think that's kind of what it boils down to.
So if
there's no secret for running uphill. It's just fitness, so, and it's just practice. Yeah.
Well, yeah, if we follow that sort of thought process, which is valid, like what would you accredit that to? Because like when you started running, like you started running on the trails and in the mountains, you didn't start running circles around the track, right? Like what would you accredit those things to? Like the bike background more than anything? Like you're not known as a guy who gets in the gym and puts, you know, 300 pounds on his back and squats, for example. So I think listeners would be curious, like what would you attribute to maybe having a good power output?
I think it's just years of doing lots of sweet spot work and threshold work. And that's just like aerobic efficiency and aerobic fitness. And it's like, I remember there's like this, basically zone two, zone three is like your highest return on your investment for your training approach. So it's like, oh, you could do 1 hour per week of zone four and a bunch of zone one, or you could do, you know, 10 hours of zone two and a couple hours of zone one and like no zone four. And I've always been in that camp. I've always been of the camp of like, let's do as much of that, you know, semi-hard work as possible and just accumulate as much time there as possible in my training. And it's kind of like the not sexy training. You're never running super fast. You're never running super hard, just a little bit here and there to sharpen for races. But that's what kind of builds over years and years of work. That's what builds your aerobic conditioning. And I'd say that like that is probably, you know, the answer. Also, like you can do a lot more of that work on the bike than you can running. So, and I've always been like a big proponent of doing stuff on the bike, doing skiing workouts, doing things like that. Running is just so brutally like hard on your body. It like just tears you apart. And so it's like, well, I could do 10 hours of running plus 10 hours of biking, or I could do 13 hours of running. And yeah.
Sure.
You know, people, you mentioned it a few times that our running background is different than yours, and it allows us to do different types of running well. And you'll hear it from the everyday athlete a lot. I wish I had run in high school and college. And I was like, yeah, there's the big advantage to that. But it took us so long to overcome the things we didn't learn and the things that we learned improperly. Mm. We were so ingrained to like, you just must hammer intervals.
Yeah.
You
every must. Day.
Because you're 800 meter, just 1500 meter runners.
Puke every day.
Like, yeah. 3 to 4 times a week.
Yeah.
You got to be hating your life. And it took so long, and it was hard for us even to take the blinders off and start reading other sources at first. Like my first year of being a high school teacher and coach, I trained the kids really poorly. Even though I was a college runner, like I wasn't a good running coach because I was doing dumb things for people who weren't aerobically developed. Right. And it really wasn't until I got out to Colorado Springs and I was running the Manitou Incline 2 to 4 times per week as part of my training. And the speed skaters and the Nordic athletes were so good up that thing. And up until that point, I had refused to believe that I like, if you didn't run, you couldn't, or I had believed strongly, if you didn't run, you would not be good at anything running related. And finally, I was just confronted with this, like, when efficiency goes out the window, you can't maintain momentum uphill very well. When it's just putting out, those sports are crushing us. And it was just like a really embarrassing stretch in my life of realizing like all this work I've done didn't actually help me for what I wanted to be good at. But then that finally, like, it takes the blinders off and you start reading every sport you can find. But in particular, Apollo Anton Ono was out there at the time, and he was very much a short track specialist, and he was crushing people on the incline, and he was doing single leg hopping up the incline, alternating legs.
Nice.
And it was just, it was mind altering to see that uphill power is so different than running a track interval.
Yeah.
And the sooner people wrap their minds around that, the better everyone else is as an endurance athlete, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that being open to different ideas and different training modalities. And, I've always said, like, whenever I read something, I love, if it makes sense and it resonates with me, I'll like try it in my training. And if I find it helps me, then I'll keep it. And if it doesn't, then I'll like move on. And it's been just like that process for myself over many years of just like what works, what doesn't, what's, and what's worth the energy to do. It's like, oh, you can do this workout, but if it's going to kill you and it's right. going to take away from all your other workouts, then it might not be worth it.
So I do want to talk a little bit about, you said, and you just sharpened down quickly for events, which never really resonated with me at all until I did an extended block of, as you would say, sweet spot or threshold training. Like sharpening down wasn't a thing when all you were doing was work. Like I never understood.
Hobie, sure.
You know, Hobie used to talk about doing that, and you always would do it. It's like, sharpen what?
Yeah.
Like the edge is going to crack if I sharpen any harder. But there was nothing waiting underneath. And that was always a huge failing point for people like myself. But you seem to be, throughout my time in this sport, the best person at living the training life that you want to live on a daily basis and still being ready for events. Like, I can't recall the last time you jumped into an event and just really had a terrible time doing it. Like, even things like Spartan Games, where you ran into a few like lift-based things that were outside your realm, the overall performance of the day like wasn't destroyed by the ability to fail out on like a lift. Like a lot of people, if they got caught on that deadlift, they wouldn't be able to perform the rest of the day. So I kind of just want your all-encompassing free flow for a while here on how you manage to train happy, train the things you like to do, not be like bound by the demands of a race, but always pivot to the race at the, I shouldn't say always at the right time, but from the outside, arrive at the race ready for the race. Because I think that your kind of cavalier, relaxed attitude will sometimes make people think that you don't think as intensely about how you got there as you actually do.
All right.
So I want to hear about that overall process.
Totally.
I know those are very, very long lead into that
very
question.
Very long lead in. Yeah. So basically, I think that the way that I look at it is I can only be so miserable for so long. And it's like, there are certain workouts that I love doing. There are certain workouts that I hate doing. And then there's certain workouts that are somewhere in between. And closer to an event, obviously the more important it is to do like specific workouts that will, you know, prepare you really well for that event. But also sometimes those are the workouts that I dislike the most. And so basically when I'm coming into an event, I'm looking at like how I'm like planning a lead in. I'm thinking like, how is this going to help me for the event? But I'm also thinking like, how much do I not like this workout? And if it's something that I really don't like, then, you know, I'll still do it, but I might only do those workouts twice a week. Whereas like the stuff that I really love doing, I'll be doing like every day or things like that. Or, so it's like, it's basically just being cognizant of that fact. I'm like, here's the 7 perfect workouts that I should do. And it's like, oh, 2 of them are awful. Maybe, and I'm 8 weeks out. Maybe I'll only do one of those workouts. You know, I'm 8 or 7 weeks out. I'll only do one of those workouts because I know that when I'm 5, 4, 3 weeks out, I might be doing 2 or 3 of those workouts. And if I do too many of them too early on, I just might not enjoy the training. And I might just like, and if I don't enjoy the training, then I'm just, I don't know. It's like a mental state kind of thing. If I'm just not into it, thing is, I'll still do it, but it's like I get more out of it when I have like more mental space to come into the training with. It's like really hard to explain. But yeah, that's kind of
it. Makes sense.
It's like, yeah.
Well, and we firmly believe that engine is engine, but it must be paired with specificity of the race.
Yeah.
Like engine is engine at the end of the day, but the race will cause you issues if there's not some specificity. So do you have you talked about you have your uphill paces combined with wind resistance charts. Like, I know you have all this in your spreadsheets all over, but do you have a set plan for when that pivot occurs based on race type? Like the difference between when you prepped for that, what was that, 50 miler down south a year or two ago in like January versus prepping for a Lula or prepping for a Jacksonville 5K sprint versus prepping for an altitude beast. Do you pivot to that at different times? Or are you always like 6 to 8 weeks out? I just start to get specific.
It depends on the event and depends on like my level of preparation, like coming into that. And also like how I think it plays to my strengths, I guess. If it's something that I think I'm already like pretty set up to do well in, then I don't have to, you know, pivot quite as early as I would otherwise if it's something that I'm like totally not ready for. But I usually find like maintain a pretty good level of fitness, always be like doing some running and some other stuff. And then, yeah, maybe around 8 weeks is like a good time to 8 to 10 weeks, depending on how, like, if it's an ultra, you need more time, I find, because you're just running. Like, you need so much muscular endurance to, like, hold up over that period of time. So you have to build that more slowly. Then, like, the fitness is already there. So if you just need to, like, translate that fitness into speed, you can just be doing, like, specific speed workouts to get it there. And those aren't as bad as, like, doing, yeah, like, to train for a Lula, I was doing workouts, like, I think I did one where I was running, like, 14 minutes on, 1 minute off, and the on was like at close to threshold, like kind of like sweet spot, and I would do that for like 2.5 hours, and like the 1 minute off I would just do pull-ups for it. So like you're just doing tons of time running at that like uncomfortable pace with like these little tiny breaks. So like workouts like that are awful, but they get you ready for the demands of an ultra, because you're just like, all right, I'm going to like totally destroy my legs and do exactly what is going to be done to them in the race. And then I'm going to recover from that. And that'll buy me more time in the race to run fast. And so, yeah, and I guess that's an example of like a workout that just I hated doing, but I had to do anyways. So you just do it.
Well,
the classic 14 by 10 workout with pull-up scissors.
Yeah, classic. Yeah, the staple. Yeah.
Just going to ask, what workouts does Ryan Atkins like look forward to, and what does he dread? Now I'm curious, like what types?
Yeah, I love just uphill hard efforts, anything from like 5 minutes to an hour, things like that. The steeper, the better. Those I love. I like biking workouts. I like long sweet spot or tempo intervals outside, like not on the treadmill. So yeah, just doing like, I think I prefer longer efforts over shorter efforts, or things that have like really short recoveries. So more training that like that ability to maintain your pace instead of that ability to like push a harder pace. That makes sense.
When you talk sweet spot training for running, are you using a stride pod or anything, or are you just taking threshold pace and knocking a few percentages off that and holding, or is it totally by feel?
I have a stride power meter thing, and I have heart rate monitor, and I have trained by feel and stuff. I think all these tools that we have at our disposal are just like really cool, and then the more you use them, the more you realize you don't need them. And it's less like, yeah, I think once you become familiar with your body and like what pace feels like what and all that, then it just becomes like almost irrelevant. I always err on the side of training easier than harder, because that's always been a good path to success. It's like save something for the race, or don't completely destroy yourself in training, things like that. So if I'm like, oh, I'm going to run sweet spot and my heart rate range is like 150 to 156 or something like that, then I'll shoot for being more closer to 150 than 156. And then, yeah, I always find that that's just better. I realize we live in like the society where it's like, you need to be destroying yourself and like rah-rah, like so macho and all this stuff. But I think for longevity in the sport and injury prevention and all those things, that it's better to just do the work and do it a little easier and like be consistent than to push yourself so hard training that the next time you have to do that session, you're like dreading it because you like left a piece of your soul out there. So yeah, that's kind of my approach there.
3 years of work is going to beat 3 great months of anything.
Right.
Every single time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's been the theme with your answers. Longevity, I feel like, has sort of been the theme with a lot of the questions we've asked you. I want to sort of, not hard pivot, but like soft pivot. And I have a two-part question for you. And I just want to see what your answer is here. And I know you have thoughts on this. So one of the things I've admired about you is like your versatility, right? And like your stoke birds are always chirping, so to speak, for everything. Like you can dabble and pursue and do well in a wide range of things. But I feel like most of your seasons did still circle the Spartan season and the OCR waters for years anyways. You did other things along the way. But and this is just from the outside. Of course, I don't know how you look at it. But two-part question in regards to that. One, it feels like it's slipping, right? Like the Spartan series, the OCR consistency sort of is disintegrating. That was a large part of your identity. Not only that, Ryan, but like you were a superstar, man. Like Spartan did a great job of pumping you up. And even back in the Battle Frog days, you were everywhere. Before I found this sport, I found you on all social media channels being pumped, right? It was like Ryan Atkins, the man, right? You were on billboards and advertisements and social media, and you were like kind of a rock star in this space. And that's gone. It really is. It's gone. Spartans stopped pumping their athletes. You know, you don't have the influx of eyes on you from that sport anymore. And I know it's a weird question to ask, but like, one, how do you, like, how's that felt to go from like being like rock star on the stage because you've been had availability of races and they did a great job of pumping you to now that's gone? And then of course the OCR series isn't worth chasing for most. Just want to know how you feel about all of that.
Honestly, I couldn't care less. I don't know.
Good.
Is that like a weird answer? I don't know.
No,
I guess
it's
I never
right.
perceived
it's a great answer.
I never perceived myself in any of those arenas, and I've just really enjoyed, you know, the opportunity to race and to train and to be fit and to chase things, and that to me is just so exciting and so cool. And like I think it's great, like making new friends and meeting new people and going to places and having these experiences. Beyond that, I don't really care about any of that kind of stuff. Like it's not what gets me up in the morning or what gets me out the door or what makes me excited or what makes me want to train harder or do that last rep or any of those things. So I could 100% take it or leave it. Cause yeah.
Fame doesn't drive you. I'm gathering. That's good. I guess part of me wonders, like, if I was in your shoes, and even me, because I was all in on at least chasing the series or big races for a handful of years, Bracken, you too, for longer than myself or anybody here. But, like, there's a little bit, like, I'm a little sad. Not anymore.
I think Ryan's had a longer
career. Yeah, that's true. But, there's a little bit of sadness with, like, you know, that was a good run, but it's gone. And that's how I very much feel about it. In general, for everybody, but myself included, I'm chasing other things now. Like any of that, I think I'm maybe getting at that question as much as anything. Like sort of like a somber, like, it's a good run, but she gone.
Yeah, dude, it's totally sad. I think what Spartan was and what Spartan could have been it's pretty amazing. And I think that we can discuss like how it went wrong and when it went wrong and who's to blame, you know, until we're blue in the face. But the fact is that it's definitely not what it was. And yeah, it's a bummer because I think that it's such a cool sport. It's like, I just always have said the fitness that you get from doing this sport is like the coolest fitness from any sport that I've ever done. It's just like this ability to do anything, anytime, any way at a high level. That's what I loved about it, or still love about it.
I don't know if you were a fan of the movie Fight Club.
Yeah. I love Fight Club.
Okay. So there's that part where he's like, Fight Club became our reason to cut our nails short and to work out and like keep our hair trimmed and things like that. I always thought of OCR like that. Like OCR was my reason to do atypical fitness things that were never working their way into my life. And it builds this overall binding fitness that is unlike anything else. And so without that, I find myself looking at the bucket in the corner or looking at my rock grips or those rock boards and stuff. Like, do I need you anymore? And I want to need that.
Right.
But you don't need it anywhere else. And so
yeah.
I don't know. The people that don't identify as OCR athletes, it does leave a bit of a gap. And I know you say you don't miss the fame or whatever, but I'll tell you what I miss. I miss being able to go pick up a few grand anytime you wake out of bed in the morning. That's not existing in many other sports. And I miss what OCR was, which was a place where tactics, skill sets, training styles, and race day adjustments mattered. Mm-hmm. You go out to a big ultra and like you're going to pace yourself correctly or you're not.
Right.
And they're going to blow up or they're not. Or you'd step on the track of the roads and you're going to run at your ultimate limit and they're going to. And there's not a lot you can do against that unless you're evenly matched with them. Then you can start to tweak things again. But OCR was a place where people who love tinkering with race tactics and styles and training could find themselves able to beat people they shouldn't be able to beat.
Right.
So do either of those two things, the easy cash grabs. And I think you and Lindsay grabbed more cash than anyone in the history of the sport. And then the headiness and the trickiness of the racing. Do you miss that? And will you find that anywhere else?
Totally. I'll miss both those things. Especially like you said, the ability to be tactical in a race in your training and to approach it with like, it's like, oh, well, I might not be the best at this, but I can like do this other thing really well. I think that Lindsay would always say, like when she was training for Battle Frog, that she was like just such a better athlete than she ever was after, because she did all these like crazy workouts and it was like just between the grip strength and the carries and like all these things and the gnarly courses, it just like you said, Bracken, you're staring at your grips and staring at the bucket sitting in the corner collecting dust. It's like if you don't have that crucible of competition to drive you to pick up that bucket and walk with it around the block, then you just like don't do it. Like humans are so soft and mm-hmm. we just want the status quo. We want the nothing. It's like, oh, okay, well, I did this running workout, so now I don't have to do, you know, I'm tired, I just won't do that other workout that I thought I might do. Where before, when we were like competing all the time, you'd be like, well, but I better go pick up my sandbag and run for a mile, because it'll hurt now, but if I don't do it, then it's going to hurt even more in competition. So yeah, it totally sucks that that's not a thing anymore. But I think I get that a lot out of from other things that I'm doing now, like climbing mountains is a good one, or ice climbing. Like I was doing a pretty hard grip strength workout today because I don't want to fall off the side of a mountain. So that's good motivation as well.
You talk about the training you don't like doing versus what you do like doing. OCR training was always what I didn't like doing.
Right.
I loved OCR racing. I had to force myself to do heavy carries. And you have all those people that's all they want to do. They don't want to run.
Right.
They don't want to hit the trails or the mountains. Like OCR was my gateway drug into finding trails and mountains. Prior to that, I do my easy runs on the track.
Right.
I was a psychopath. I didn't know that there was this world.
Just going in circles.
I ran my first OCR race and ran off the trail and rolled my ankle like 9 times. I was like, this, I think I want to do this.
Yeah.
But I never wanted to train OCR. I thought it was dumb. You feel like an idiot and it's tiring in a way that wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you let that go sometimes and it's, I'm optimistic someone's going to save it.
Yeah.
But the cards aren't coming up predicting that right now.
Yeah. Ugh. It's too bad. But yeah, I think that like, it's funny to think about like how CrossFit was such a success and how it seems like Hyrox is becoming a success. I don't know. I haven't done one, so I can't really like, I don't know how successful they are. It just like looks like it is, but it's kind of interesting to think about like, what is it about OCR that made it kind of flatline? Is it just Spartan's inability to market it, or is it inherently just too hard for the average person, or like too gritty, or like not cool enough, doesn't have like that sex appeal of like standing around in like a rubber matted gym lifting things up randomly and grunting like you're just out there running by yourself in the woods for hours? Like what is it that made it kind of have its moment of excitement and then fizzle out? I don't know the answer to that, but something to think about.
I don't know. I don't know how it was ever a thing in the first place. The concept of like taking a jungle gym and extending it out over mud and fields and hills like would be a non-starter pitch to me in a business meeting. But once you're out there, I feel like it encapsulated something that everyone wanted. And then from there, yeah, how did it get screwed up? I can't believe it was ever a thing. But once it was, it felt like this unstoppable progression that suddenly just got derailed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have to remember, through 2019, it was, those were still, it's twilight years, but they were still good years. And then we had COVID, and then they made no money, and then it was sort of a thing, and then they stopped paying people because they weren't making money, and then they stopped pumping the athletes, and the events weren't happening, and then they couldn't confidently put on events and draw the people in with the money. But like pre that, they did okay. We even opened in Jacksonville in 2020 before they shut things down. It was the standard. We still had video coverage. They still had money. Then it shut down. And I think they made every wrong decision in the process. And I think the main wrong decision they made was, and I've said this before, is they lost their superstars. And when you don't aspire to be like anybody or train like anybody or aspire to have the fitness Ryan Atkins has because he's shoved down your throat on social media every day, you stop aspiring for those things and you're less motivated to show up. And then when the top athletes stop showing up, then it trickles down. And I think it's very much a simple, I mean, it's a lot of webbing there, but I think it was doing okay pre-COVID. Yeah. Bracken, you were at the Spartan Race World Champs in 2019. Ryan, I think that was your year after Eco Challenge, and you still put out a huge performance, if I'm not mistaken. But I think it had to be a combination of that pivot, though, right? And the inconsistency in product, you know? I think paying dollars to be on TV, so to speak, with the backseat interviews and all that, like, although some of you look back and think that's cheesy, like, that got me into the sport. It's what I randomly saw on TV. Like, I don't know. I think it's a 10-part equation, right? Some of all those parts.
Totally. I think that also hiring people who make the ultimate decisions for the company who didn't do the sport and who didn't have any experience in endurance sports or athletics, I think that is like one of the root problems that killed the whole thing, because all of a sudden,
yeah,
you had people making decisions that had no rapport to the big decisions that had no rapport to the actual company. They were just looking at it from like a black and white spreadsheet financial balance perspective, right. not from like a, yeah. And I think that's what kind of killed it.
It's interesting for me to look back in time and realize that Joe DI and Robert Coble, for anything they got wrong, they were convinced that athletes needed to be front and center and the sport needed to be seen on some version of TV.
Yeah.
And even if they got everything else wrong, which I actually am one of those people that I really like Robert Coble. I thought he was indispensable to Spartan. Joe D.I., it's a different story maybe, but like for whatever they did right or wrong, they understood two pieces inherently and they went all in on that side. And everyone after that seemed to know better on every single front, but kept coming up with the athletes are replaceable and we're not going to pay for production.
Yeah.
And those two things, in hindsight, make you miss Robert Coble, make you miss Joe D.I. And that's not a phrase I thought I'd say, I miss Joe D.I., but like he pumped the athletes.
Yeah.
For whatever other flaws he may have had.
Yeah, no, I like Robert. I think that I agree with you 100%. They saw the value in the sports side of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can't name a sport that's exciting that you can't name an athlete.
Right.
I'm racking my brain. I even like Joe D.I. Joe D.I. made sure I got paid. If I did anything, Joe D.I. would be like, I'll write it out of my own bank account. You can get that money. He did it to Flight and Burst for commentating for Tahoe. I commentated 1 year and he was like, I was like, well, what am I going to do? You guys going to reimburse me? Whatever. He got that money in my account as fast as I asked for it. Now I couldn't get a penny out of them. Do they still owe you any money, by the way? Or are you one of them that have cleared all the checks?
No, they owe us money. I mean, the big one now is the 2022 pro team stipend that, I mean, it's like $4,000 for, you know, a lot of the athletes who are in the tier one were promised that money. We like basically, it was like one of the reasons why we raced that year, because it was like, okay, here's this $4,000 that'll get us to a bunch of the races. Cool. And now they're basically decided that they don't want to pay that. And I'm hearing through the grapevine that they're having like internal meetings where they're just deciding not to pay it. And talking to Joe DeSena, he's like, we're going to pay it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I don't know. It seems like a lot of the athletes are threatening a lawsuit and it's crazy, man. And then, I mean, they owe us from World Championships last year, a bunch of money from that. Other than that, like, we're mostly squared up, which is good. Like, a lot of the other things, I think they're working through the prize money lists, but I mean, it's just the whole thing is just fishy and it's kind of scummy and it's kind of shitty because they just keep, I don't know, it's like they keep saying COVID, they keep saying this, they keep saying that. But at a certain point, you're like, okay, well, are you going bankrupt or are you paying people? Because like this in between kind of just like paying whoever you want, whenever you want thing is just really bizarre. And like the numbers are going back up, people are doing the races, you have all these people that you pay a bunch of money to be CEOs who are supposed to be so good at their mom, you know, at this, but obviously they're not. Who knows? So yeah, that's an ongoing. I could show you the email thread. It's like hundreds of emails.
Really?
Oh yeah.
That's unacceptable. And the public facing side gets excuses like this, this, or this. But what everyone forgets, the inexcusable part is what you said. They have weekly meetings, standing meetings, and the agenda gets brought up and someone actively has to say, nah, F them.
Yeah.
We're not paying them right now.
Right.
Actually, let's not pay them ever.
Yeah.
How about that? Let's put that to a vote.
Right.
Like they actively have to. This is digital record keeping.
Yeah.
Doesn't slip through the cracks. These are people making active decisions out loud to not pay their debts to athletes and vendors.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's so scummy and it's so awful. It's like, and meanwhile, like, I don't know what these people are making, but it's guaranteed it's a lot more than most of the athletes are making.
No one in management, no one at sea level has skipped a paycheck. We know
skipped
that.
Skipped a meal, yeah.
It cashes every month.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, the whole situation sucks. And honestly, I think that is part of the reason why Spartans in the position they are, because they've just burned so many bridges and shut themselves off from so many sponsors and relationships and things like that. And I'm sure they have a reputation in the industry of just being a bad thing to deal with. Like, they change sponsors more often than people change underwear. It's like they have like a month with someone and then it's like, boom, on to the next. And it's crazy. But yeah.
Yeah. We from time to time get messages that why are you negative about the state of the sport? You're not helping to save it.
Mm.
And the reply is, well, there's some fairness to that, but are they worth saving?
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like if they've just proven that we are assholes, do we want to save them? And it's not everyone. Like their employees are fantastic human beings, mm-hmm. and we've seen it from the ground up from year one.
Yeah.
The day-to-day operations are so well run at the races. Those people are some of the best people I've met in the sport, are the race directors and the build crew and all of that.
Totally.
But the higher-ups are just proving that they're not worth saving.
Yeah.
And I hate even uttering those words out loud.
Yeah. Yeah, it really makes me... I could talk all day about things like this. But yeah, it's like the same old people just making poor decisions and getting paid way too much for what they actually do.
Let's put our positive pants back on. Let's do that.
Positive pants.
Let's put our positive pants on.
Yeah.
Because I want to get to this anyway. So, Ryan, you're going to be a dad. You're going to be responsible for another human life. And mm-hmm. for a guy who's living full tilt, and your wife, Lindsay, lives full tilt, I got to imagine there's been some conversations around, like, how are we going to approach these things and maintain our passions, right? And our ability to do what we love while raising a kid. Tell me about that. What discussions have been had in regards to all of that? Like, what are your thoughts going into it? It sounded like when we talked to Lindsay last, she was really ready to be a mom. Like, she wanted to start a family. And I don't know, whatever comes along with that. We haven't had that part of the conversation with you. So where's your head at, Ryan? What have you guys talked about in that regard?
Oh, man, I think I'm the kind of person who just loves challenges. And I think that I see this as like a new challenge. It's like, oh, man, how am I going to do all this stuff but have this tiny human with me? I don't know. I'll just strap them to my back and just send it. So I'm like pretty stoked about that. I think it's going to be wild. And there's going to be like, it's going to be like the ultimate.
You just might have to like temper your enthusiasm on descents.
Yeah. Yeah.
That might be it.
Just slow down a little bit. Maybe put some bubble wrap around them or something. Call it a day. But yeah, I think it's going to be wild. And I don't know the answer. I know a lot of people who I think are really good inspirations for me, who still are able to do a lot of stuff with young children. I remember going rock climbing once with a buddy, and he had this swing rigged up that was like 70 feet in the air, and his kid was just flying out over this cliff, and they were loving it. So I was like, man, I've got to do that someday. I think it's like all aspects of life. You can just sit at home and just kind of take the easy way and just kind of, you know, rock the crib back and forth while you watch Netflix. So you can get out the Thule and go cross country ski 100K while the kid's sleeping or anything in between. So I'm like, yeah, I mean, I guess that's my broad stroke approach. We'll see how it all pans out, but it's going to be pretty wild. I'm psyched. I want to get really good at heavy carries, that's for sure.
Well, it's like that Mike Tyson quote where everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Totally.
But the second half of that quote is also that if you had a plan in the first place, you react to getting punched in the face a lot better.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you know the punch is coming. So having the plan that, yeah, I'm going to roll with this and I'm going to do crazy stuff with this and it's going to disrupt it, but I'm still going to do it. Like, that's the way forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to be fine.
That's the plan. I was like,
so question then, just about like, cause like, for example, you're going to Denali and adventuring and you're still running some pretty big races that involve travel. Logistics can be tough there, right? Like my sister and brother-in-law, they have two kids and they said, we are not changing our passion for travel once the kids come. And they've done two international trips a year from the time the baby could fly, the first one, until now. The kids are like 6 and 4, and they're more well-traveled than I've been. They've been to every continent and everything, and they've lived full tilt, right? And they didn't let it slow them down. They seem genuinely happy. Like, they're like, we're not going to, you know, kids are going to be brought up with our lifestyle, and they have been. I envision that for you, but I don't know. Like, do you think you'll have to temper enthusiasm with big trips and racing? Or have you and Lindsay talked about like, hey, Ryan, why don't you go to Alula and get this one and then I'll get the next one. Like, have you had talks about that at all?
I think Lindsay's ready to not really race. I think she's always, I think, found it a little bit more stressful than I have in terms of like the racing and stuff. Whereas I just really enjoy it and love the process. So I think she's like ready to like actually retire. Don't quote me there, because who knows. But I think she fully expects me to keep she fully expects me to keep racing, just I think with an altered capacity, maybe. So like you said, it could be me leaving for, instead of a week, maybe only 4 days for a race, or it could be the whole family coming to an event, or it could be doing less events. I'm not exactly sure how it'll look, but I want to keep competing and I want to keep racing and doing fun stuff for sure. I just don't know what that will exactly look like.
Well, Bracken, I bet you have something to say about that. You went through that with all your kids.
Yeah, I mean, we had a little different setup where my wife she ran in college and then she hated it. So all she wanted to do was ever train. She didn't want to race one bit. So it was real easy for us to just like pack up and follow me anywhere I went. But I knew I had a limited shelf life. I came into a sport with decent fitness and a low level competition around me. And every year the competition got better. And she and I were very open with each other that we knew we had a limited shelf life. I was going to get surpassed real quickly. And then I did. And then I was going to be able to hang on the top three for a short amount of time. And then that was gone. So we knew it was a limited time thing. And it was easier for me to step out when it was done. I was always a mid-distance runner masquerading as a mountain runner like that. I'm in a totally different boat than Ryan. Ryan's made his living off it. I had exactly 1 year where I replaced my living with race earnings. One, you know, this is not the same type thing, but yeah, it's luckily you start, unless you find out there's a second one in there, you start with one and there's two of you and you get to play zone defense on that kid. And then by the time you get to two, you're used to it. Now it's just one-on-one. And then by the time you get to three, the first one's raising the third one. Like it's a nice incremental process.
Makes sense.
So what does interest you though?
What interests me?
With OCR, there's a gap there. You have months of training and traveling and racing that doesn't really exist. There's rumors that Alula is going to be like a quarterly thing or twice a year thing, which, I mean, you can swing the finances of the family off just two Alulas a year, probably.
Yeah.
So that would be nice. But like in terms of what's going to replace that racing-wise, have you locked that down yet? Or do you have leads on that?
No.
Where are you going to pour your competition?
I haven't really fully decided that. Right now I'm qualified for UTMB this September, but I don't know if I'm going to – and I'm registered. I don't know if I'm going to race because the kid will be like 3 weeks old at that point. So I don't know if that'll be in the cards. I think, yeah, I don't know. I'd like to climb more mountains. I'd like to run more ultras. I'd like to run more long trails. I'd like to do like multi-sport type things. I like just doing, I think what really excites.
Which sort of multi-sport?
I don't know. Like not like racing triathlon, like, you know, riding my bike to a mountain and then skiing it or something like that, or like link ups of like enchainments of cool objectives, things like that. Like
mustache multi-sport.
Exactly. Yeah, so I don't know exactly what the immediate future is going to hold, but yeah, I don't really feel like this. I guess I'm happy with like focusing on Denali right now. I'll probably do maybe some sky races this summer. Really enjoy that stuff, and then see how things are once the baby's here and stuff, where the passion lies.
Are either Lindsay or you, outside of like sport and earnings, are you guys working like a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a quote unquote traditional job or part time or anything like that?
Lindsay's been working marketing jobs for year and a half now. She worked part-time that every day. And then, I mean, my job right now is renovating this house, so I'm working on that every day. I also coach some athletes, and that's about it. Yeah, for me, it's pretty busy, but honestly, between renovating a house, a bit of coaching, and training, it's like busy life.
That's enough. Yeah. Well, it rings a bell. I think Lindsay probably told that to us last time we chatted. I believe she said she was looking at doing that now that you said it.
Yeah.
But it's been a while. I'm putting myself in your shoes. Like right now, like, you know, me and my wife, we're like, you know, dinks, as you call it, like dual income, no kids, right? Like I don't have to watch my bank account ever. I don't have to, like, I do what I want because it's selfishly living life. I'm not worried about a third party human, but we're in the works, right?
Right.
And so I would just like wonder, like when you're an athlete and you're relying on race winnings and other things, of course, too, like the underlying sort of like, oh boy, like, do we continue down this path or do we have to at some point like find another way to, you know, like kids aren't cheap and all that crap. So it's like, have you guys had any talks about any of that, like more traditional roles or expanding your coaching or like anything like that? I'm just very curious from like a human level, like a logistics, I'm going to be a dad athlete level.
Oh man. Yeah. So, I mean, we have an Airbnb right now that we run. So that's like one source of income and a bit of work. Yeah. But it's also like, yeah, I don't know the answer to your question because it's crazy.
Well, I'm just thinking if I had an Airbnb, I'd pump that thing so hard to my athletic followers and they'd be like, I went to Ryan Atkins' house and I lived there and I trained out of there and I ran those mountains. You would have that so booked up with people in our circle. I'd go book it. Sure, let's go.
And one of them murders you.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Is your Airbnb in the Northeast? Is it your house that you'd lived in out that way?
No, yeah. It's like it's a separate building over by the ski hill here in Sutton. So it does pretty well. It's booked up pretty consistently. So it's good. But I mean, like, frig, dude, it's crazy. Like, last year we had to redo the retaining wall on that, redo the roof on that, it's like, oh sweet, here's a source of income. And then it's like, boom, then we had to spend $50,000 on like all these expenses that came out of nowhere. So it's like, life happens. At this stage, honestly, I just don't even, I don't know, money just doesn't mean anything anymore. It's like, there's so many just unforeseen expenses that just like sideline you that now I'm just like, well, you just keep working and you just keep doing stuff and hope it all works out.
Good news is everyone thinks children are expensive, but babies are not.
Right.
And young children are not.
Yeah.
They're only expensive if you're expensive.
Mm-hmm. My buddy was like, yep, all it needs is a boob. You got one of those, you're set.
Yeah.
Like, oh, perfect.
Yeah, two is even better. Yeah,
we're good to go.
Yeah, the people that need all the matching outfits and all the best toys and everything, all the electronic. Yeah,
right.
Children are expensive if you buy them things, but everyone around you buys them things.
Exactly.
I don't do a thing for my kids.
My goal is to buy nothing for my kids. I'm like, how little to pull them around in.
Like, I buy sports things for my kids.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't bought them a toy in 5 years.
All our friends have kids that are like 3 years old now. So we're like, the timing's couldn't be better. Just kind of roll right into that. Yeah.
Give us all your old shit.
Kids don't care about hand-me-downs.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm more asked that question, but by the way, like, you see a lot of, like, you know, an NFL player gets in a commentary or they buy a sports drink company or they do something in their second lease on a career. Right. For example, like, Bracken and I are full-time coaches now. Like, that's what we do, right? Like, I'm not making money off of my own racing. Are you kidding me? But I make money on the back end because now we coach and we have a running public training plan. So it's more like the curiosity stems from like, okay, like, you're still really capable and you're 36 or 7, you forget, whatever. But so you got some years left, but I'm wondering if you've thought, you know, about like the next phase. That's all. That's more what I was curious about. Maybe we have to have this conversation in 7 years. I don't know, but...
Yeah, so I think I'm going to start doing some arborist work. I've always enjoyed cutting down trees, and I've got a few friends who are arborists and have agreed to like kind of show me the ropes and start climbing trees. And I think that with my rock climbing background and engineering background, that it'll be a pretty easy transition. So that's kind of like once I have this house finished, that's, I think, the direction that I'll start going in. But I don't know. There's a, who knows what happens with this life we live. So I could be racing in the Middle East every 3 months for the rest of my life.
My sister's dating an arborist.
Nice. Yeah, it's a good job.
Cutting trees is oddly satisfying, by the way. Cutting trees is, if nobody's done it, it's so oddly satisfying. It's hard to describe until you've done it. But cutting trees is one of the best feelings, I think, on this planet. When it's all said and done, it is wonderful. You get that same feeling when you either get out the chainsaw or the saw and you start going to work. It's good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. It's amazing. And chainsaws are super fun. Maybe it's like an ancient, caveman type thing of like cutting wood for your fire, provide for your family, like in our DNA.
You just bought 24 hours of life.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, I have a question for you that I didn't expect to get to today, but you said you are qualified and registered for UTMB and that you may not do it, but I don't want to focus on the may not. Let's just say you are doing it. Are we going to see the first year-long commitment to an event from you, or are you going to approach it much in the way you've done things in the past, where as you get closer, you'll do more for it?
No, I think that that would be a pretty fun way to do it. I think that once I get back from Denali, which will be around June 10th, I could just spend my June, July, and August just getting ready for that race. I feel like that would be very cathartic, just to fix this house up, run a bunch of miles, and then watch a new life come into this world. And that could be my year. And then run 100 miles.
Yeah.
Pretty good year.
Well, my first Spartan Race World Championship, our first child was 6 weeks old.
Nice.
And it shouldn't change things, but the last hour of that race had a different emphasis with that. Ooh. I'd never experienced it before. So maybe if you guys find a way to swing it, this little baby is going to be your rocket booster in the second half of that
Sick.
Race.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
3 weeks, though, that's a really small window.
Yeah, but I've also heard that my friend told me that the first 2 years, the guy is just useless. So, I mean, I figured the first 3 weeks got to be really useless. We'll see.
Is that a guy friend or a girlfriend?
What do you think, guy friend? Yeah, he's like, you only need 2 years. I was like, good to know.
Okay. Other than one big thing, which is be present, right? Which is sort of probably the key.
Right.
Like, exist nearby.
Probably important.
Although I can't do anything.
Yeah.
Right. Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, for ours, we really respected the first 2 weeks. Where, like, we had this midwife we worked with who was big on the internal healing, and I didn't let Lisa go up and downstairs for 2 weeks. Like, if she had to go up, she was carried up. So that's just sharpening. Drop your volume, carry your wife up and down the stairs.
Perfect. Yeah.
Nap with the kid.
Yeah.
It's nature's taper.
Yeah, this could really be the perfect prep. The approach that no one's thought of.
You have to do it every year if it goes well.
Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you, Ryan. I enjoyed this. It was good catching up.
Yeah. Cheers, guys. Thanks so much.
To send people to your socials and stuff, because you do a good job of keeping people in the loop and you got some cool stuff going on. We have a number of pure runner listeners who aren't in the OCR world or trail world. So do you want to just send them, like, let them know where they can follow along and all that?
Yeah. Instagram's probably the easiest, and I'm Ryan Atkins Diet there. Place to check me out. Might be more, I don't know how much running stuff is there all the time.
It's adventure stuff, but do you rode that Atkins Diet train whenever that started, 2005 or something? You got right on that? Or
all the way to station.
Stole it?
Yeah. Who knows? I just think I'm clever, and then it turns out I'm not, so. But you just live
big
with it.
Big keto guy, huh?
Big keto.
Oh, man, how could you? I don't know how you could be an endurance athlete and not have carbs. Be brutal.
It would be. All right. Well, we'll wrap this thing up, man. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it. It sounds like you got some woodworking to do or some pipe to lay. So we'll let you get back to it.
Pipe to lay always. Thanks, guys. Cheers. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Ryan.
If anything resonated with you on today's episode and you're curious about taking your training to the next level, check out therunningpublic.com, where we have a training plan to fit your needs.